full of vitality, and he was still so weak. Nevertheless, Nico knew he had to do something or she would be gone, lost. He got his legs under him. He grabbed the wall and pushed against it, made it to his feet. Nico said with all his strength, "What about what I want?" The two of them looked at him as if he were a child. Tempest's gaze caught his and shocked him. He'd never seen that face before, full of storm and hardship and something much, much older than his commander.
"Do you wish to choose between us?" she said, very gently, not more than a rustle of leaves in the grass.
Tempest didn't say a word, just folded massive arms and kept Nico's eyes locked in his.
"No, no, I just want..."
She was only a girl, after all, the most beautiful girl, whose feelings were hurt. He didn't understand what the Riddler was doing. "I have a bit of a situation," the Riddler told her, never looking away from Nico, "that requires him. If you can heal him, then don't delay on my account. Otherwise we need to reach an understanding or bring these escapades to a close."
"You invited me."
Her wide eyes sought Nico's.
"You asked me to come. I never would have intruded."
Then to Tempest.
"Life to you, Riddler, and everlasting glory."
And she was gone. A quick retreat of flowing hair and long legs and eyes like the sky. He could never remember if she went out the door or through it, because his commander was standing in the way. After a wordless interval, Tempest helped him to his bed and went away, and he fell asleep again. His sleep was restless, his heart beat fast. Rum-rum-pa-pum-pum. His side hurt, his flank ached, his buttocks burned. Tat, rat, tat, tat, tat. He slept all day and into the evening. He didn't want to think about what had happened. Long spear thunking into flesh. If the Riddler wouldn't let her be here, then what would Nico do? Man staggers back, impaled, groaning. What could he do? His heart was aching. Rat, tat, tat. And then he felt her, in the dark, the softest touch, the sweetest sigh, breath on his cheek, long hair sweeping over him like heaven. He said,
"What? Why?"
She said, "Shh. Just take this blessing for us both," and touched him with those hands, this time everywhere, not just where he was torn and healing. And something in him gave up, gave way. The sounds and sights bedeviling him faded away and were gone. For a single instant in all the universe of right and wrong and up and down and who and why, nothing mattered but the touch of her, and her lips, and her soft, soft skin, and that silky hair all around him, her breath in his nostrils, sweet meadow in the curve of her neck. It was as if the two of them lay in his rest place, on the blue-green grass in his star-shaped meadow, where his stream ran clear and his body was everything he needed it to be. He said, Please, please, she said. Of course, never fear. Be brave, my love, young hero. Steadfast, and everything will work out aright.
And everything in that one moment was so perfect that he barely knew he breathed. He remembered a strange white house down a little path as she slipped one long thigh over him where he lay on his side, where he'd last done something like this. But that was so long ago. He wasn't sure he could remember what he'd done there or who that was he'd done it with. It didn't seem to matter. Randall was fetching his ball when three boys came by his barracks quarters and he had to turn back into a man.
"Master Randall," called Chorus, the storm godson. "Master Randall," called Artan the seer. "Master Randall," called Lysis the Theban, as all three stood outside his quarters in the late afternoon gloom, and the rain came sheeting down.
"Yes, yes," he said, opening his door to them as soon as he was dressed in his hillman's green trousers and low boots. He was very pleased at how quickly he'd been able to manifest clothes and don them this time.
"Sink says we can go to Aphrodisia House if you go with us," said Chorus, trying to hide his excitement. "And if there's time, perhaps go see my mother Illyra at her shop first. I'd like her to meet you. She'd be so impressed," said Artan, bashful but determined.
"First," said Lysis, "I want to introduce Master Randall to my father. We'll lose the light soon enough. Master Randall, my father is Charon the Theban. He's doing the evening oblation at Harmony's altar. If you could just wait until he's done..." But Randall couldn't wait.
"I'll be honored to meet with Charon, but some other time, Lysis." He tossed the ball up and down in his hand. "The Riddler said something about this foray. I recall now. Well," he said, "if we're going to do this, go get some horses, Chorus, while Artan and Lysis tell me about their adventure on the beach. I've been wanting to hear."
And so they began on it, this sensitive endeavor, Randall guiding three unwitting young fighters, guileless and clear-eyed and brave. Randall almost felt sorry for them, but he remembered when he had had stars in his eyes and dreams of glory in his head. He couldn't tell them more than they needed to know. And he must learn all that they knew, even what they didn't know they knew, for things to turn out right. After Chorus left to get the horses, Randall kept tossing the ball up and down in his hand and asking the two remaining boys questions about their encounter with someone on the beach. Someone who might have been Shamshi. The ball was only a little bit special. Any ball, really, would have done for Randall's purposes, but he particularly liked the texture of this one, made of sea sponge. It was full of wonderful holes and tunnels where you could send a soul to learn a trick or two, and keep it there a while. Artan was a Bandaran, and he knew induction when he saw it. He didn't fight it, but he gave Randall a knowing look and said, "In there?"
"Unless you think you can remember everything you saw and all you did out here. After all, this isn't magic. You learned it on the Misty Isles. There's nothing to fear, is there?"
In front of Lysis, Artan agreed. "No, nothing to fear. Lead on, Master Randall." While Lysis looked between them, uncomprehending but trusting, and let his mind go where Randall led. Just as the boy's induction was complete, Randall's nose began to itch. Rather than sneeze, he rubbed it with a charmed handkerchief given him by the Dream Lord. When Chorus came back with four horses and a disgruntled look, the rain had stopped. By then Randall had a good idea what the chase after Shamshi in the sand had been like. Only a few details eluded him, but those would have to wait. This plan was carefully calibrated, cunningly arranged, and he had his part to play. Even if it meant riding an actual horse, he was willing to do whatever he could for his one-time partner, Nicodemus. Sequestered in his sick room and seeing no one but the Riddler and the dancing girl. Or at least not seeing Randall. Chorus and Artin were Nico's trainees. Randall had been honored that the Riddler had chosen him to take charge of them for this evening's foray.
"Now, stepsons," said Randall,
girding on his sword belt before he swung up on an old brown gelding.
"There's danger about these days. While we ride, I want everyone to stay together. And if I give an order or a signal or a maneuver code, you obey me as if I were the Riddler. Is that clear?"
All the boys agreed and looked fierce.
"I am, you should know, the only warrior mage ever to serve with the sacred band of stepsons. Any difficulties with this? Any hesitations, questions, or problems? If so, tell me now before we leave the gates."
There were none, not from the strapping red-haired Chorus, the blonde and handsome Lysis, or the dark, compact Artin, as the four of them splashed out the gates and into the Riddler's plan. The trainees mustn't know or even suspect that ahead lay a different kind of adventure than most boys ever have, and perhaps a different kind of peril. And manhood. "Old enough to kill means old enough to die," the Riddler had reminded him when using the young stepsons to lure Shamshi was discussed by the four of them who could shield their planning from the quarry. By Tempest, Jihan, Ishad, and by Randall himself. Their adversary was a mind invader, Bandaran trained, and deadly. Randall had Artin ride beside him, all the way to town, since Artin was the seer, the most interesting. The Riddler wanted the measure of these youths taken by an objective observer. If there was a hint of things to come, a future to be glimpsed tonight, Artin was most likely to see it. As promised, they stopped by the sad little scrying shop of Artin's mother, Illyra, and Randall was at pains to be polite. The matron was heavy-set, ill-used, and stooped from her burden of regret. Even so, she loved her boy and lit up when she saw him. Artin said,
"Mother, this is Randall. The stepson's..."
"Hazard," said Illyra, and curtsied, a rather awkward sight.
I didn't think there were any hazard-class mages practicing here in Sanctuary,"
she ushered them in, offering tea at her little round table.
"There aren't," Randall said.
They sat. Chorus looked at the ceiling. Lysis peered around with huge, excited eyes.
"Sorcery is prescribed here, as you well know, Illyra. Its mechanisms turned to dust. I'm allergic to dust. I'm visiting with friends. Your son Artin is making quite an impression."
This woman might be poor, but she was no fool.
"One of your students, Merrycat, apprenticed here for a time," Illyra told him carefully.
Unlike Artin, Illyra could glimpse the present and the future, but feared her own talent. I can't see Artan. I've told him that, and I'm telling you.
Your boy just wanted to visit, Randall said kindly. Sometimes we do things simply because they are the right things to do. At least we do in the Sacred Band.
Elira made a warding sign, but she must have known where her son was apprenticed. So it wasn't the mention of the Sacred Band that caused her concern, though it could have been. It was something else. This woman had foreseen something, despite no cards on the table. Perhaps in her tea. Her level of skill required a focal point. Randall said,
I will buy each boy a quick reading and then we must go.
So she read cards, the typical this upside down and that crossed over the other, for Chorus, who would have long life and prosperity, and for Lysis, who would write history, be a leader. Until she got to her son, and then her cards seemed to betray her.
Three of swords reversed. Death reversed. The citadel.
She stopped. Randall was glad she did. Then Artan's mother said,
My son and his two friends have a destiny. These three portents together make a greater reading, but you know that.
Randall did. He'd known it before he came, but he hadn't expected this blousy, worn-out fortune-teller to see it. He paid her, murmuring polite inanities and suggesting that since the Thebans were looking for an oracle, Elira might apply for the job.
Oracle?
Elira said.
Sybil, mother,
Artan said, proudly. A seeress. You would make a wonderful one.
Elira walked them out. At her threshold she caught Randall's arm and held on. He let the boys go ahead to the horses.
What are you doing to my son, Hazard? What awful danger, what horrid sacrifice.
What? What did you see? I thought you couldn't see Artan.
A mouse can see a cat stalking up to its hole, she said scathingly. If you harm that boy, I'll curse thee. And that, Hazard, I still can do.
He wasn't worried. He didn't say he lived a plane away or that she didn't have the skill, he said.
Never fear. We're in a bit of a spooky patch, but the entire Sacred Band will protect Artan if he needs it. And I myself, you have my word.
Your word, Hazard? I'll hear it now.
So then he had to vocally, formally give his word and promise to protect Artan on his Hazard's oath, and his Sacred Band oath, which he really would have preferred not to do, heading into the maw of destiny with these three unknowing boys tonight. The mild summer evening was fragrant now that the rain had stopped, with friends clustered around him, Simmias could nearly imagine he was back in Thebes. Two god's altars crested the hill. On the flat below they had built a modest cook fire. Here, under the sparkling stars, Simmias waited with eight of his brothers for Charon to arrive. Simmias' partner, Perses, was summing up his tale of atrocities in Downwind.
The city guardsmen were like the Kyries, doom-bringers of merciless vengeance.
Finished. The curly-haired young poet leaned back against Simmias and sucked from his wineskin. You just like the simile, Perses, Simmias chided his right man. Thank the goddess there are no Kyries here.
But you're right. That city guard bears watching. As all our new friends bear watching, all the sanctuarites and the stepsons...
Simmias had called this meeting. He was a greybeard, an aristocrat, a seasoned leader. They listened when he spoke. Only Charon had a tighter hold on Theban hearts. Gorgias spoke up, his shattered face only angles in the firelight.
We suffered no casualties during this sweep, but the city guard lost two, so how fearsome can they be?
Gorgias was even more sour than usual. His partner Siren stayed behind in the barracks tonight. Siren had fallen from a horse and hurt his hip today. An evil omen. No one knew how long the hip might take to heal.
And the stepson's enemy escaped again.
Dark Aegis and fair Archaeus sat side by side, both with chests wrapped. Aegis said,
"The stepsons have more blood oranges today."
Archaeus said,
"Let's make Charon get us some of those oranges, even if we must give half to the goddess."
Simmias said, "There are more mysteries here than oranges. Before we left for the downwind sweep, I dreamed I died in that sortie with an arrow through my throat,
and that you died beside me, Percy, shot in the eye. It didn't happen. Goddess be praised. So now I'll tell you. But those two city guardsmen died that very way, that very day, during the sweep. There are stranger things here than Thebans know about."
Now Charon, their warrior priest, arrived and sat down cross-legged where Perseus made room for him.
"So," Charon asked, "this august body all together? Why are we here, Simmias?"
"We're here," said Simmias with great care, "because we don't understand what we see. Who is that woman going in and coming out of the sick room of the Riddler's second-in-command? All the stepsons claim they don't know her. And why does it rain all the time except when she tends to stealth called Nicodemus? And where do the blood oranges come from? Not from the kitchens."
Charon raised both eyebrows. In the firelight, the lines on his forehead deepened. "We're not in Thebes anymore. It doesn't rain all the time, but their storm god has his altar here above us. It rains when he wishes. As for the rest, you know," he said.
"You all know."
9 men swore they didn't. Simmias, who'd kept company with some exalted minds in his time, said,
"She could be Thetis, savior of Zeus, mother of Achilles, whose son was greater than his father. Or perhaps not."
He looked about him archly.
"If not, then who else could she be?"
"It could be Thetis," Perseus agreed,
who liked this game and played it with glee.
"But she could also be Themis, mother of Prometheus, holy prophetess of righteousness and justice."
Others joined in, suggesting goddesses from far and wide and one side of heaven to the other, proposing to name the one who brings the oranges and stops the rain and tends the hero lying in the Riddler's bed. Eventually, Charon tired of the game and said,
"We all know. If none of you dare say, then I will, lest we anger all the gods and goddesses from here to there."
Everyone looked at Charon, and this time, no one was off-handed or flushed with wine, or pretending to be either.
"So say, then, Charon, if you say you know and say you dare," said Simmias.
The one who appears in a girl's or woman's form here is Blessed Harmony, our tutelary goddess, and I say it so because I know it so. And now, that said, a prayer is in order to keep mouths and eyes and hearts pure, since a goddess walks this earth with us, watching everything we do and hearing everything we say. Remember, she is justice. So be just in all you do and all you say. And be circumspect. Pay respect to her, for respect is the coin that deities most crave. And you all know I speak the truth. For each and every brave soul here has been afraid to speak her name in the same breath with that stepson's name, or any other heathen, lest we offend our generous goddess of balance and righteousness. With that said, the prayer begins, and Simmias wonders silently as mercy is requested from the goddess and forbearance sought, if any of them have already committed some offense they might soon regret. Their goddess seldom walked among them in their homeland. Until Chironea he'd never seen her in the flesh. Then, in sanctuary, on the lighthouse spit, she had appeared in all her divine glory to Charon, to his son, to the band's commander and his right-side partner. Long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering back impaled, moaning. The dream of death by crossbow bolt is still clear in Simmias's mind. He will make a substantial offering on the altar up the hill tomorrow. He will sacrifice the finest lamb he can find to pay for any wrong he may have done, to buy his way out of any unknowing or unwitting slight to his tutelary goddess Harmony. But slights aplenty will be here, where stepsons serve a wild god of war, where more than flutes are needed to calm savage hearts, and where many a Theban may take it amiss that their beloved goddess, Harmony, visits stepsons and graces their rooms, but not the hearts and company of her very own. In Thebes, as everywhere else civilized, it is well known that gods and goddesses only walk the earth to test the faithful and to punish the failings of humankind. So Simmias wonders aloud as he hugs young Perseus close, this poet like a son to him. Have we already earned our fate? Is our wool carded, the spindles of our days all spun round? When gods and goddesses walk disguised among men, the wise don't celebrate. They cower. They bow their heads. If they can, they run. If they can't, they hide. If they can't hide, they purify themselves for trials to come. Shrewd Charon looks up from the fire and says, his face underlit and solemn, and if they are pure of heart and balanced, they count their blessings, which the goddess has bestowed and will bestow. But thank you, Simmias. I was just getting to that part. Ishard, Stratton calls outside the low gate which once opened for him and now does not. There's no rain. The young moon is bright, casting teasing light upon the odd little house where his love still lives and where so much had gone so very wrong in former times. The ghost horse nuzzles delicately at his shoulder, touch of velvet lips, nudge of muzzle.
Jump the fence, the ghost horse snickers. She won't mind. She loves us. We love her. She'll have sugar beet in there, and carrot. Jump the fence, or I'll do it for you. There's no time to waste.
It stamps one forefoot, stamps the other, swishes its tail and pushes Stratton forward with its nose. Once, twice, until Strat's knees touch the gate. Beyond that gate is everything forbidden, everything he longs for, everything that had nearly killed him and had left him with a crippled shoulder years ago.
She healed my shoulder, you know, he tells the ghost horse. Look.
He raises his arm above his head and tugs on the ghost horse's long forelock, which never gets longer, never loses a hair. But the horse already knows. Those wise eyes with their oblong pupils shine a deep blood-red tonight.
There's no time to waste.
The ghost horse paws with its forefoot.
Let's go get her. Go for a ride.
But Stratton can't do that. Crit would be so angry, so disappointed. Strat had promised not to come here alone, but tonight he has good reason. He has business here. The ghost horse whickers again.
We love her. She loves us. The night's still young. The rain stopped. Think how far and fast we could run together. Away from everything. Away from everyone. Just we three.
And whickers low, soft lips picking insistently at his chlamys.
Just we three.
Then a square of light appears beyond that little gate, beyond the twisting walk up those stairs he's trod so many times. Strat thinks she must kill to eat, kill to live.
She takes life to have life. So do we all. Everybody kills for food. No apologies necessary. But she kills people. Souls, old, weak, and sick, deserving, and foul. So she's unclean, and here we are.
She's right in front of him, not bothering to cross the distance in between, but on her side of the gate, not his.
What is it? She breathes. Nothing is finished yet. We are just getting underway. Stratton, why are you here?
Then her eyes grow huge, and she floats so close he can feel her breath and the heat of her against his chest. The ghost horse snorts and pushes him forward, muzzle at his back. He's dumbstruck. He has no answers, just trumped-up excuses. Then he seizes the one he'd used to brave this path and stand here.
The commander said, Randall's started. You need to know that, the Riddler said, but what has Randall started?
You don't need to know that. Tempest shouldn't have sent you. He reaches out a hand to touch her cloak, to feel something, to prove she is really here with him, not just an apparition. A simulacrum she sent out to meet him in the garden in her stead. Now he's caught up in her cloak and she's caught up in his passion and there's nothing in the world that matters as much as a shard. And the ghost horse, standing guard at his back.
Stratton, she sighs. Stratton, not now. When I call, I'm not always calling you.
She breaks away and backs away, but their lips have touched and his breath comes fast, and he knows the ghost horse is right. He doesn't say a word. He must not grab for her or in any way compel her.
Not now, not now, she croons, as much to herself as to him. I'm occupied. You need to go. Don't ask a single question, not even of yourself. Just go. Forget you came tonight. And come another night. Oh, come another night. I'll have something for you, I promise. And a carrot for your horse.
Next, she reaches out and touches him, merely a soft tap upon his forehead. From somewhere far inside that house, across all the empty space of her gate, and her yard and her steps. And now he doesn't remember why he came here. But he knows he's welcome back here with his ghost horse. Here where it all began for him and for the horse who'd died and come back to life for love of him. Another night. Although she never once stepped beyond her gate. Never let him inside her yard with its black roses and thorny bushes and its nightshade. He's now sure she will. Another night. And the ghost horse is rubbing its head against his chest, saying,
Another night. There will be another night. For all of us. Just we three. To ride. Forever.
End of chapter 29.
Chapter 30. The Blessed One. In the cloying embrace of Aphrodisia House, Lysis stared around, alert for danger close at hand. Sanctuary was still reeling from the downwind sweep. All three trainees were determined that nothing untoward would happen to Master Randall on their watch. Sacred Band protocol prompted Lysis to empty the big salon before letting Master Randall enter. But he couldn't do that tonight. They had orders not to disrupt the brothel's business unnecessarily. He and Curus made a circuit of the main room as Critias and Stratton had taught them, taking note of everyone and everything. Artan stayed right next to Randall in case the stepson's mage became a target. Well-dressed men with fancy clothes and fancy hair and fancy beards drank at the bar. Caravan masters in silks and brocades, expansive fellows, some in flashy cloaks, some in robes and lace, a few with the sterner garb of men hoping to look pious. Perfume and seduction, diffuse light and suggestive laughter. Perhaps 30 people were in the salon, all told. What would his goddess Harmony think of this place where Lysis, her blessed one, stood now among drunkards and harlots, perverted priests and libertines and thieves? Menace and dissipation were everywhere.
"Be ready to kill any and all," Sink would have cautioned.
Lysis was in a strange city, on an oddly ill-defined mission with no other Thebans here to help him, only stepsons. At least his bolt-shot thigh no longer hurt. He used no crutch, wore no bandage. He could ride as well as walk. His scars were turning decorative. He will always carry those scars, reminders of how close to death he'd come in this exotic, erotic, and dangerously unpredictable place called Sanctuary. The bordello assaulted his senses, titillating him. Harlots slid and rubbed and wriggled sinuously among the men like cats wanting to be fed. Women and girls displayed themselves on burgundy sofas and sat in little groups at tables. So many girls, legs never together. There were very few male prostitutes here, just the occasional coal-eyed boy approaching puberty. "Master Randall," Lysa said, "I don't..." I've never... The last time I was here, I was on duty. My father was with me. Stealth was in command.
Master Randall had a sharp face, large ears, and fine bones like a nobleman, with no hint of brawn or swagger about him. Not Lysis's image of a fighter, but this was the stepson's famed hazard. The mage seemed in no way hazardous to Lysis, who was a head taller, and nearly a third heavier.
"Just what's expected of us here tonight? What should I do?"
"What should you do? What's expected of you?" the mage echoed. "What do men usually do in houses of prostitution, Lysis? Didn't you take a woman out on the beach at the Theban Fete or someplace?"
"No,"
said Lysis flatly. His father would have had his hide for fraternizing with loose women, but he didn't say that. He said, as brusquely as he could, "I was working, tasked, like Artan, to find Shem. I told you in that trance."
"I answered your every question about chasing Shem on the beach. At our celebration on the spit, we danced a little, that's all us young sacred banders."
It was important to Lysis to make sure Master Randall knew he wasn't holding himself aloof, as some of the older Thebans did. He wanted to be a full-fledged stepson, accepted and included.
"Let's get you something at the bar. Tonight you can remedy that problem if you wish,"
the warrior mage said gently, his ears flaming red, guiding Lysis toward the men and girls, drinking and smoking.
"Or not, your choice. The stepsons expect to pay for your evening one way or the other."
"Oh, I see." He did not see. Why would virginity be a problem? Lysis was armed and dangerous, ready to do his job. Nothing taught in Thebes suggested that prowess with harlots was a requisite for a fighter.
"Of course you see, or you will."
Randall guided him over to the bar and ordered for them both, then turned to face the room. Lysis wasn't sure he wanted to let down his guard, or could. He drank the wine that Randall chose while pipes and lyres played sensuous songs. Aromatic smoke curled around his brain as Chorus came up to them, where they stood, a black-haired girl in tow.
"Lysis, this is Shomi,"
Chorus announced proudly as if he were introducing a queen. But she was a whore, nothing special. She was a few years older than Lysis, with guarded blue eyes. She held out her hand to him. Beside him, Randall shifted. If he didn't know better, Lysis would have thought that Randall was checking his weapons. He took Shawmy's hand and let it drop. "I'm Lysis, son of Charon, son of Thebes, of the Sacred Band of Stepsons, Blessed of Harmony," he said, introducing himself to Chorus's girl. And all that was true. The goddess Harmony had said to him on the beach, where the Riddler and Stealth and his father could hear, "You are truly mine." Everyone knew. Thebans called him the Blessed One. Some even said it to his face. And he was changed since then. Truly blessed, guided, protected by Harmony. When Shamshi, and he knew it was Shamshi, had tried to kill him from ambush that night on the road, a supernatural hand had knocked the crossbow bolt away, so it skewered only his thigh, not his heart. Then Stealth had given him the dart tube. He'd used one of those ancient darts on Sham when he and Artan chased the fugitive through the dunes. He knew it was Sham then,
just as he'd known it was Sham who shot at him in the dark. Sometimes he could sense the Bandaran reaching out to touch his mind. Long spears dunking into flesh. Man staggers backward, impaled, sobbing. Balance was not just for Bandaran's, but also an attribute of Harmony, his goddess. And Harmony herself was here in sanctuary with her faithful. Perhaps even here with him right now. Her grace had brought the remnants of the sacred band of thieves here, saved them all. Chorus's harlot finished appraising him with her big blue eyes. You have so many titles, so many names. I'm very impressed. No one calls me anything but Shami. Her breasts were showing, her eyes were ringed with shimmering blue powder. She was bolder than a Theban wench. She added, I'm happy to meet any friend of Chorus's Lysis, son of Charon. Her expression was practiced, welcoming, but not too much so. Lysis could feel Master Randall stiffen, could see the warrior mage watching intently. Chorus said, Lysis, Shami has a friend here tonight, Marycat, who wants to meet you. Chorus gave him a conspiratorial look. Shami's the one who found the dart tube. Leaning back with his elbows on the bar as he had seen Stealth do, Lysis ducked his head to meet Shami's blue eyes. Perhaps he needed to show these stepsons that Thebans were not all divine friends, and nothing else. Master Randall jostled his elbow, then shifted close and whispered, Be still. Then the mage took a step away from the bar, approaching the girl.
Shami? Shami who found the item? 10, 11 years ago, it must have been.
Shami said, That's me, fetchingly. But let's not talk about how long ago it was. Master Randall said,
Do you still have it?
And moved in on her. No, has it? The whore backed up, right into Artan, coming up behind her.
What's this?
Chorus asked in his Son of the Storm God voice. Artan touched Chorus on the arm. Thunder rumbled outside.
Who does?
Randall's voice popped like a bullwhip. Shami's head was level with Randall's chin, but she looked up at the mage as if he towered over her.
I did what you told me, Hazard. I gave it to the stepsons when they came back to town. I couldn't get to the Riddler. I'm just a...
Cora said, Master Randall, Shami gave it to me. I gave it to Stealth. Stealth gave it back to me, then took it away again when Lysis got shot and gave it to Lysis. So what?
So what?
The mage whispered in that way the veteran stepsons had, which screeched in your soul like fingernails on a slate. Now Lysis saw the fighter in this mage, iron whetted to kill, anger held very tight, and something else, chagrin. The warrior mage whirled on Lysis.
You have it? Give it to me.
Lysis almost flinched.
No!
He took his elbows off the bar. The stepson's warrior mage might as well have caught a dog stealing dinner from a cook pot. In front of Artan. In front of Chorus. In front of the girl. And in front of all these sanctuarites.
I said, give it to me.
Fire seemed about to issue from the mage's thin nostrils. They quivered.
No! The Riddler's right side partner gave it to me, after I was wounded in the line of duty. He said it would serve me well if Sham came at me again. I used it on Sham when we chased him on the beach, I told you. No, you didn't tell me that. You said you shot him with a dart tube. Not that dart tube.
give it to me, now.
Lysis was embarrassed. He was angry. He didn't know what he'd done wrong. He said,
Stealth gave it to me. If he wants me to give it to you, he'll say so.
Too many ears were cocked. He said, I'm going over there to a table where it's not so crowded. He wanted to say, I'm getting out of here. He wanted to go back to the barracks. He wanted to talk to his father. He was the Blessed One. This foreign sorcerer shouldn't be scolding him like this in front of everyone. Artan, Kuris, and Shawmi were looking helplessly at one another. The whore seemed about to cry. She tugged on Kuris's arm, whispered in his ear. The warrior mage stared at Lysis, black murder in those eyes, his face so white that freckles showed on it, a muscle jumping in his jaw. Lysis headed for a table. It wasn't empty when he reached it, but girls scattered, seeing his scowling face and his hand on his short sword's hilt. Then he was alone there. And then he wasn't.
Lysis, we're supposed to obey Master Randall's orders as if he were the Riddler, remember?
Artan said urgently under his breath.
Well, he's not, is he?
Artan pulled out a chair and straddled it, eyes round.
You'd better give that dart tube to him. No!
Now it was too much of an issue. He couldn't back down.
Anyway, he'd left it in his room.
Leaving it behind was obviously a bad mistake, but he didn't want to admit it. Not to any of them. Then Chorus came. Shawmi stayed behind, joined by a prettier girl, and they were talking with animated gestures to the warrior mage. Chorus said, You're in trouble, but you know that. He sat, stuttering a chair under him.
How can he be? Artan said tremulously, rubbing his arms. He didn't do anything wrong.
He's doing it now. Chorus leaned forward, elbows on the table. You want to be a stepson? You want to be accepted? You want Stealth and the others to respect you? You're what, 2, 3 years older than I am, and you don't know when you're porking up this bad?
Doesn't say much for your common sense,
or mine, for being seen with you. You're messing everything up for everybody here. I want to spend the night with Shawmi, not escort you to the barracks under guard.
Chorus scraped back his chair and got to his feet in one quick move. Lightning cracked and thunder rolled closer now. Don't make it rain, Artan called after Chorus querulously. Especially if we're leaving.
But Chorus stalked away, over to the mage and the girls.
He can't make it rain, Lysis said. That's just superstitious talk and coincidence.
Artan looked at Lysis pityingly. Over by the bar, the warrior mage and both girls spoke with Chorus, who took Shawmi under his arm. Then Master Randall left the group and approached the table where Lysis and Artan sat. Somehow, everyone else had moved away. There was a circle of emptiness around them. Lysis was miserable, trapped, exposed. The mage had more freckles on that thin face than Lysis could ever remember seeing on a grown man. They looked like mud or blood spattered there.
Lysis, Randall said. You need to give me the tube. You don't know how powerful it is or what to do with it.
I did fine with it. I did as Stealth taught me.
And now he had to say it before things got any worse.
I hid it. After I used it on the beach, I don't have it on me.
Lysis had been told by his father to give the tube back to Nico when Lysis could ride again. He'd meant to do it, but by then Stealth had been injured, hard to reach, sequestered in the commander's quarters. "Then let's go get it, now," the warrior mage decreed.
"Kurus doesn't want to leave,"
Lysis said, crossing his arm. "Kurus doesn't have to leave.
He'll have different orders,"
said the stepson's mage, already striding toward Kurus and the door. End of chapter 30. Chapter 31. Proof of Heaven. Waiting for trouble to come, Tempest has to solve this now. Two forces, or more, at odds over this man, Nico, who'll always be a boy to Tempest, who faces every horror and evil that man can do and never flinches. Listening to Nico's breathing as he sleeps, Ascalon is right. These are dangerous days for this hero half-made. For this Nicodemus over whom, above all other men, the worst and the best contest. Tempest never sleeps. He keeps his vigil over Nico, impatient, brooding. With his God-given sword beside him on the floor, propped with his back against the door, Tempest is waiting for the wizard boy or the Theban goddess to come. Too many forces are stirred up tonight, on purpose, by his design, at his command. Flush the abomination, Shamshi, to kill it or send it straight to hell. Confront that other power, drive her hence. He wants to grapple with enemies this night, as he's seldom wanted anything. Wait much longer, and Stealth would be well enough to insist his fate was his own to choose, and perhaps choose wrong. Or die trying. Tempest would not allow that to happen. He needed no second bed for himself in this little room of his. He needed something stronger than a door to keep out the damned and the celestial. He wasn't sure which was worse. Nico's breathing grew fast, then steadied. Tempest looked out the window. Almost time. Dawn was reaching up, pale fingers to pull down the night. He forsook the door. He walked over to the bed. He touched the forehead of his injured fighter with the back of his hand. No fever now. No cold sweat. No clammy skin. Time to take control. "Stealth," he says to this fighter who might be dying, might be healing, might be healed, might be damned, might be fated, but was, in the end, just a man. "Wake up. Time to go outside." All night long, on this night he'd chosen to poke sticks into holes too long undisturbed, he'd expected a pounding on the door, a slithering through cracks, a visitor who could not be forfended, and got none. Nico's hair is too long. In the gray light of morning's first promise, it falls into his eyes. A week's growth of beard shadows his face. "Riddler?" He struggles to sit up, half on his left side. Tempest doesn't help him, just stands there, judging his strength.
"We need to get you out, moving. Get dressed, stepson. We're going up the hill today."
It's chiaroscuro in the little room. Nico sighs and nods, brushes his hair out of his eyes.
"You're right. Too long in here."
He swings his legs over, chary of his right side, but game, and sits, breathing hard, elbows on his knees, back bowed. Tempest throws his